Hello and welcome to Political Dynamite. I'm Mike Stewart with Adam McGabbro in our studios in New York. And this is our inaugural edition of Political Dynamite, our first episode, our first broadcast. And how appropriate that it happens on Inauguration Day. Did you happen to listen to any of the coverage this morning, Adam?
Yeah, I did. Good evening. How are you? This is Adam McGabbro. I did.
Indeed, it is.
I thought one of your comments was particularly comical.
Yeah, which one was that?
I liked how our friend John Ashcroft did not sing.
Oh, you heard that, did you?
Yeah, I did. I enjoyed
that. We got some emails about that, in fact. Just to let people know, we were doing some live coverage. Many of you probably heard it, of the inauguration. And this guy, I forget his name. Do you remember his name?
No.
Anyway, he started singing "Let the Eagle Soar," right?
Right.
And that's when I chimed in. But yeah, we got some emails. Some guy in San Francisco said that he was sitting in his office chair, just sort of listening to me, and I was using sort of the C-SPAN-esque voice, like, "The president is now entering the Capitol building," you know, et cetera, et cetera. We'll just play the clip. I didn't think it was that funny, but like, this guy really loved it. So here it is. Sure. I guess the one thing that we can be grateful for is that John Ashcroft isn't singing right now. So that's. That was that. That was really the only humorous remark I made during our coverage of our morning coverage of the inaugural. I tried to sort of like keep journalistic integrity going a little bit. But did you have a chance to watch some of this?
I watched a piece of it.
Right?
Did
you see one of the things that I was really impressed about, Adam, was that C-SPAN itself was covering the inaugural, right? You know, the procession, the cavalcade of, you know, politicians and power brokers. But C-SPAN 2 was covering the anti-inaugural, the counter-inaugural coverage, which I think we ought to send some kudos out to C-SPAN for doing that.
Yeah.
I thought that was really amazing.
Yeah.
We were doing the inaugural coverage itself, so we didn't get a chance to see a lot of that, but some of our listeners told us that C-SPAN did a great job. So, having a chance to watch the entire inaugural speech, I found it schizophrenic.
Ooh. Okay. I like that. I like schizophrenic.
Right.
That's a good word.
In a sense, I found it loaded with contradictions. The whole thing, I thought, was this was a Bush ideological push for the American idea of liberty and freedom.
Okay.
And you made an excellent point in the conversation we had before we went on the air, which was that freedom in America, it naturally evolved as a grassroots movement.
Absolutely.
You know, the woman's right to vote, Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement and all the other heroes associated with that. This was freedom of the people and by the people. And
I want to comment on that to cut you off.
I want to say
that in that conversation off the air that we just had, freedom is something that is realized. It's not something that is mandated by another one, another person, another country, another state, to tell another country or state, "We're going to set you free." It's something that individuals realize to attain, to change. You know, freedom may be exactly what one has that another one may say, "You're not free." You know, in 1950, we were as free as a bird, but some of us were exactly.
Yeah.
But the fortunate few that were on the on the other side,
right?
We are free.
Yeah. If you were pale and beige, you were fine.
Yeah.
And
they were free in 1950.
Yeah.
If somebody said you're not free, we would say you're wrong. But lo and behold, you know, 180 degrees later, we've changed our ideology.
Right, and one of the things that you mentioned,
and we realized we're wrong,
that we talked about, was what if there was another nation that decided, you know, to sort of interrupt the evolution of freedom in the United States.
Exactly.
By deciding this is the way it's going
to
be.
I would grab my gun,
yeah,
and I would tell my friends to grab their gun,
right,
and we would be considered the terrorists.
Right, the insurgents.
The insurgents that would be protecting right. our country from these, you know, these other, you know, the other,
right.
the other
right.
country.
And we would be running, as Bush quoted, that he wants to set the fire of freedom across the world,
right.
you know, and that would burn oppressors, etc. But I think one of the, as we comment on the speech, why don't we play it?
It sounds great.
You know, we'll stop here and there to make comments, and I've got a few, and I know you do.
Yeah.
So let's just, we'll just start with the speech. We'll
sounds
do that
great,
right
man.
Now.
President Cheney, Mr. Chief Justice, President Carter, President Bush, President Clinton, members of the United States Congress, Reverend clergy, distinguished guests, fellow citizens. On this day, prescribed by law and marked by ceremony, we celebrate the durable wisdom of our Constitution and recall the deep commitments that unite our country. I am grateful for the honor of this hour, mindful of the consequential times in which we live, and determined to fulfill the oath that I have sworn and you have witnessed. At this second gathering, our duties are defined not by the words I use, but by the history we have seen together. For a half a century, America defended our own freedom by standing watch on distant borders. After the shipwreck of communism came years of relative quiet, years of repose, years of sabbatical.
Okay, at this point, I have to say that the president seems ignorant of history when he says that after the Cold War there was a period of calm, sabbatical repose, as if there were no other challenges facing the United States at the time.
Discredits everything else.
Right. I mean, look what he's discrediting. Arms for hostages crisis, the Iranian hostage crisis, the bombing of the Marine barracks in Lebanon,
right.
The war in Grenada, the first World Trade Center bombing,
Panama.
The bombing of the coal, the bombing of the military apartments in Saudi Arabia,
uh-huh.
like terrorism.
Sure.
This isn't something new. 9/11 didn't bring our first experience with terrorism, and he implies that this is the case,
right.
where in fact Clinton and other presidents were actively working against terrorism,
uh-huh.
preventing terrorism on our shores.
Right.
And he seems to be ignoring history and taking credit for
right.
for this new war on terrorism.
Right.
And it's a war we've been fighting for a very long time.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, you might also want to add that history starts with George Bush and 9/11.
In his eyes, right?
Exactly.
Right. All right, we'll go back to more of the speech.
And then there came a day of fire. We have seen our vulnerability, and we have seen its deepest source. For as long as whole regions of the world simmer in resentment and tyranny, prone to ideologies that feed hatred and excuse murder, violence will gather and multiply in destructive power and cross the most offended borders and raise a mortal threat.
The only thing that has changed is that we were attacked. We've attacked. Similar things have happened, like a 9/11, in other parts of the world. But since it's happened on our soil, all of a sudden, there's an interest to more tyranny, more simmering hatred. It's always been there.
You know, Adam, I think that's a really good point. And I think another thing about this, just this last statement here, was this is a Bush hallmark. Be afraid. Be very afraid. Right? All right, let's continue.
There is only one force of history that can break the reign of hatred and resentment and expose the pretensions of tyrants and reward the hopes of the decent and tolerant, and that is the force of human freedom. We are led by events and common sense to one conclusion. The survival of liberty in our land increasingly depends on the success of liberty in other lands. The best hope for peace in our world is the expansion of freedom in all the world. America's vital interests and our deepest beliefs are now one. From the day of our founding, we have proclaimed that every man and woman on this earth has rights and dignity and matchless value.
I think at this point it's important to say that Bush means that for everyone except gays and lesbians.
Oh, ooh.
Right?
Sure, sure.
Who else?
I would also mention Jews and people who don't believe in Christ, which has been said. That has been said by Bush, which is not a public thing. He believes that if you do not accept Jesus as your Savior, you will not go to heaven. Therefore, you're
right.
Damned.
But I think the difference there, though, is that he knows that's a line he can't cross in public policy.
In public policy.
But definitely, he's trying to amend the Constitution and basically have a federal definition of marriage as between a man and a woman. So I think definitely he's excluding gays and lesbians, you know, and perhaps maybe in his final year he'll attack Jews and Muslims later. I don't know.
That's a stretch.
But listen to American Independence Radio's Political Dynamite. That's why we call it that. You're free to comment by sending your email to AmericanIndependenceRadio@hotmail.com. Adam's comments are his own. We'll continue now with the speech.
Because they bear the image of the maker of heaven and earth. Across the generations, we have proclaimed the imperative of self-government because no one is fit to be a master and no one deserves to be a slave. Advancing these ideals is the mission that created our nation. It is the honorable achievement of our fathers. Now it is the urgent requirement of our nation's security and the calling of our time. So it is the policy of the United States to seek and support the growth of democratic movements and institutions in every nation and culture with the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world. This is not primarily the task of arms, though we will defend ourselves and our friends by force of arms when necessary. Freedom, by its nature, must be chosen and defended by citizens and sustained by the rule of law and the protection of minorities. And when the soul of a nation finally speaks, the institutions that arise may reflect customs and traditions very different from our own. America will not impose our own style of government on the unwilling. Our goal instead is to help others find their own voice, attain their own freedom, and make their own way. The great objective of ending tyranny is the concentrated work of generations. The difficulty of the task is no excuse for avoiding it. America's influence is not unlimited, but fortunately for the oppressed, America's influence is considerable, and we will use it confidently in freedom's cause. My most solemn duty is to protect this nation and its people from further attacks and emerging threats. Some have unwisely chosen to test America's resolve and have found it firm. We will persistently clarify the choice before every ruler in every nation. The moral choice between oppression, which is always wrong, and freedom, which is eternally right.
Okay, so here Bush is basically laying it down. He says that he's going to clarify the choice between oppression and freedom with every leader in every nation.
Right.
My question is does he include China with a long history of human rights violations and some startling revelations about religious persecution in China right now, with whom we share most favored trade status? And what about Saudi Arabia?
Well, there's money to be made.
Yeah, and oil to be had, right?
Just exclude that.
Saudi Arabia alone just recently flogged several dissidents for just participating in a demonstration, a nonviolent demonstration.
Right.
They were whipped and caned.
Right.
Not to mention, like, beheadings.
Sure.
The imprisonment of anyone who opposes or speaks up against the Saudi royal family.
Okay, so you might want to say that oppression, in his eyes, is a selective state of oppression, not in our eyes, but in the eyes of our economic interests, in the eyes of our political interests. We could care less about oppression to these countries because we need them. We make money from them. They make money from us. We have a relationship. So let's forget about what they're doing.
All right, let's go back to the speech.
America will not pretend that jailed dissidents prefer their chains, or that women welcome humiliation and servitude, or that any human being aspires to live at the mercy of bullies. We will encourage reform in other governments by making clear that success in our relations will require the decent treatment of their own people. America's belief in human dignity will guide our policies. Yet rights must be more than the grudging concessions of dictators. They are secured by free dissent and the participation of the governed. In the long run, there is no justice without freedom, and there can be no human rights without human liberty. Some, I know, have questioned the global appeal of liberty. Though this time in history, 4 decades defined by the swiftest advance of freedom ever seen, is an odd time for doubt. Americans of all people should never be surprised by the power of our ideals. Eventually, the call of freedom comes to every mind and every soul. We do not accept the existence of permanent tyranny because we do not accept the possibility of permanent slavery. Liberty will come to those who love it. Today, America speaks anew to the peoples of the world. All who live in tyranny and hopelessness can know the United States will not ignore your oppression or excuse your oppressors. When you stand for your liberty, we will stand with you.
I think, like, here again, it's important to point out that there's people all over the world struggling against some sort of oppressive dictatorship. And we just talked about China, and we just talked about Saudi Arabia. And I wonder,
we can talk about them anymore.
Right. And do you think he's going to hold them to the fire now? Adam, what do you think?
No. Absolutely not.
Right?
Why would he? Why would he?
Right.
Why would he? Why would he?
I think the question is why not, right?
Because it has nothing to do with his agenda. His agenda is, in my eyes, hold freedom accountable to those countries where we benefit, period.
Where we have an economic interest.
Period.
Right. All right, let's go back to the speech.
Democratic reformers facing repression, prison, or exile can know. America sees you for who you are, the future leaders of your free country. The rulers of outlaw regimes can know that we still believe as Abraham Lincoln did. Those who deny freedom to others deserve it not for themselves. And under the rule of a just God, cannot long retain it. The leaders of governments with long habits of control need to know. To serve your people, you must learn to trust them. Start on this journey of progress and justice, and America will walk at your side. All the allies of the United States can know. We honor your friendship. We rely on your counsel, and we depend on your help. Division among free nations is a primary goal of freedom's enemies. The concerted effort of free nations to promote democracy is a prelude to our enemies' defeat. Today, I also speak anew to my fellow citizens. From all of you, I have asked patience in the hard task of securing America, which you have granted in good measure. Our country has accepted obligations that are difficult to fulfill and would be dishonorable to abandon. Yet because we have acted in the great liberating tradition of this nation, tens of millions have achieved their freedom. As hope kindles hope, millions more will find it. By our efforts, we have lit a fire as well, a fire in the minds of men. It warms those who feel its power. It burns those who fight its progress. And one day, this untamed fire of freedom will reach the darkest corners of our world.
This is just amazing. This untamed fire of freedom. It's rhetoric. It is. But I mean, in the context of a war right now, where, I'm sorry, but George Bush is just telling us right now he's going to set the world on fire. I mean, he's got a good chunk of the Middle East burning right now. And, you know, hospitals are filled with people that have been tinged by the flame of fire. That it's just really strange.
It's strange wording.
Rhetoric.
Yeah.
I want to say almost, what I want to say, he has this delusion of grandeur right now, I think, in this particular portion of the speech when he speaks of the flames, the fire of freedom. And
is he God? I'm just
I don't
curious.
Know. It seems a little psychopathic, warmongerish in a way. You know, of course, we're going a little far. But in the context of everything that he's done so far, to characterize freedom as this pan-global burning flame that's either going to light your way or burn
you. Or burn you, one of the
right.
Sure.
And, you know, it's burned more than it's enlightened right now, I think. And
well, either you're with us or you're against us.
Well, yeah, sure. And, you know, who's lighting the fuse, you know? It's George and his pals. So, well,
political dynamite.
You're tuned to Political Dynamite on American Independence Radio. We'll continue with the speech right now and more commentary.
Few Americans have accepted the hardest duties in this cause, in the quiet work of intelligence and diplomacy, the idealistic work of helping raise up free governments, the dangerous and necessary work of fighting our enemies. Some have shown their devotion to our country in deaths that honored their whole lives. And we will always honor their names and their sacrifice. All Americans have witnessed this idealism. And some for the first time. I ask our youngest citizens to believe the evidence of your eyes. You have seen duty and allegiance in the determined faces of our soldiers. You have seen that life is fragile and evil is real, and courage triumphs. Make the choice to serve in a cause larger than your wants, larger than yourself. And in your days, you will add not just to the wealth of our country, but to its character. America has need of idealism and courage because we have essential work at home, the unfinished work of American freedom. In a world moving toward liberty, we are determined to show the meaning and promise of liberty. In America's ideal of freedom, citizens find the dignity and security of economic independence instead of laboring on the edge of subsistence. This is the broader definition of liberty that motivated the Homestead Act, the Social Security Act, and the GI Bill of Rights. And now we will extend this vision by reforming great institutions to serve the needs of our time. To give every American a stake in the promise and future of our country. We will bring the highest standards to our schools and build an ownership society.
All right, so here we see Bush, like, he's basically introducing us to what we've seen before in his earlier press conferences and so forth. And what he's talking about is Social Security destabilization and his Every Child Left Behind.
Yeah.
concept. Whereas there's no real fundamental way. There's not a single economist, I think, right now that agrees that this is a goal that can be accomplished with the privatization of Social Security and the amount of money that's necessary now to achieve the sort of reforms that he wants to accomplish inside the education system in the United States could only have been accomplished in the Clinton years when we had this surplus economy, when we had the luxury economy of the Clinton years.
Right.
And he's just dragged, he spent that surplus.
Well, Gore wanted to make a lockbox.
Right, yeah.
And
that, yeah.
Blew up.
Sure, yeah, okay. Yeah. He took a crowbar to it, our boy here. And so who's going to left to pay? So an ownership society. Well, you know, we all owned that surplus, you know,
right.
And he spent it,
right.
You know. So I think he's trying to tell us right now that we're on our own.
Yeah, he's telling us we're on our own by the interests of the speech. This is the first time we're talking about something that's very important.
Right, but in a sense, he's telling us it's important, but you're going to own the problem.
Right.
You know. Just
your hands.
Yeah,
your
it's
hands
an interesting point here. He doesn't really discuss it much, but something to bring up.
Mm-hmm.
Here we go.
We will widen the ownership of homes and businesses, retirement savings, and health insurance, preparing our people for the challenges of life in a free society. by making every citizen an agent of his or her own destiny. We will give our fellow Americans greater freedom from want and fear, and make our society more prosperous and just and equal. In America's ideal of freedom, the public interest depends on private character, on integrity, and tolerance toward others, and the rule of conscience in our own lives. Self-government relies, in the end, on the governing of the self. That edifice of character is built in families, supported by communities with standards, and sustained in our national life by the truths of Sinai, the Sermon on the Mount, the words of the Quran, and the very faiths of our people. Americans move forward in every generation by reaffirming all that is good and true that came before, ideals of justice and conduct that are the same yesterday, today, and forever. In America's ideal of freedom, the exercise of rights is ennobled by service and mercy and a heart for the weak. Liberty for all does not mean independence from one another. Our nation relies on men and women who look after a neighbor and surround the lost with love. Americans at our best value the life we see in one another and must always remember that even the unwanted have worth.
This statement we just heard right now, I think, is the genesis of the overturning of Roe versus Wade. The Supreme Court. I think we're hearing the beginnings of the end of a woman's right over her own body.
I would agree with you, Mike. I think that I just want to comment on something we just said off the air. George Bush has the capacity now to appoint in the future new people that can possibly overturn Roe v. Wade, or can certainly influence, you know, seriously influence decision making on that subject.
Right, not just in the Supreme Court, but Republican control of the Congress as well.
Absolutely. And in addition to that, I think he is morally obligated to do so, just like he's morally obligated to spread freedom.
Moral obligation. You're not saying...
I am not saying... Absolutely. I'm not saying I think this. I'm not saying you think this, or you know, the majority of this nation thinks this, but he thinks this, and he makes...
Right.
He makes a lot of rules these days. I think there's no part in his mind that thinks he even in question of these subjects. He's very, very righteous in his decisions.
Right. All right, let's continue.
And our country must abandon all the habits of racism, because we cannot carry the message of freedom and the baggage of bigotry at the same time. From the perspective of a single day, including this day of dedication, the issues and questions before our country are many. From the viewpoint of centuries, the questions that come to us are narrowed and few. Did our generation advance the cause of freedom? And did our character bring credit to that cause? These questions that judge us also unite us, because Americans of every party and background, Americans by choice and by birth, are bound to one another in the cause of freedom. We have known divisions, which must be healed to move forward in great purposes. And I will strive in good faith to heal them. Yet those divisions do not define America. We felt the unity and fellowship of our nation when freedom came under attack. And our response came like a single hand over a single heart. And we can feel that same unity and pride whenever America acts for good, and the victims of disaster are given hope, and the unjust encounter justice, and the captives are set free. We go forward with complete confidence in the eventual triumph of freedom. Not because history runs on the wheels of inevitability. It is human choices that move events. Not because we consider ourselves a chosen nation. God moves and chooses as He wills. We have confidence because freedom is the permanent hope of mankind. The hunger in dark places. The longing of the soul. When our founders declared a new order of the ages, when soldiers died in wave upon wave for a union based on liberty, when citizens marched in peaceful outrage under the banner Freedom Now, they were acting on an ancient hope that is meant to be fulfilled. History has an ebb and flow of justice, but history also has a visible direction set by liberty and the author of liberty. When the Declaration of Independence was first read in public and the Liberty Bell was sounded in celebration, a witness said it rang as if it meant something. In our time, it means something still. America in this young century proclaims liberty throughout all the world and to all the inhabitants thereof. Renewed in our strength, tested but not weary, we are ready for the greatest achievements in the history of freedom.
Mike, does it grab you at all that we, as a nation now under George Bush rule, can do no wrong?
I could see where you would come away with that from this speech. I think that that every inaugural speech is sort of cast in the penumbra of patriotism. So it's supposed to be a celebration of American freedom. It's supposed to be this idea that we are a beacon of liberty. But one of the things that I think this speech is accomplishing more is that liberty is not a beacon. Liberty and freedom, as he's discussing about it, is a cloak. He's wrapping this cloak of liberty and freedom around the caskets of American dead, of boys, and Iraqi
absolutely.
Dead. So how many more Iraqi dead than American dead right now?
Well, it doesn't matter because they're Iraqi. Let's just point it out.
No, geez, Adam.
That's obviously, I don't believe that.
Right. I know you don't. But you're making a point. This is some American dead.
We don't talk about it.
Right,
and
right.
It's not important in our media. It's
right.
Not important with George Bush.
We discuss American dead to a degree, but we really don't discuss the level
we don't discuss
of
humanity.
Iraqi carnage.
Right. Since we're on the subject of humanity.
Right, exactly. So, anyway, to get back to my point is I think that this speech, he's wrapping that folly of war based on the lie of weapons of mass destruction, of impending doom, mushroom clouds, this threat he posed to his neighbors, to the region, and to the world, which did not exist.
Right.
and he's wrapping this folly in the cloak of freedom and liberty.
Right, and we buy it. And that's, yeah, sure.
I think a lot of people buy it. A lot of people listening to American Independence Radio don't buy it.
Right.
You know,
right.
And we're preaching to the choir here.
Right.
But yeah, that's a good point.
I'd say a good chunk of people in this country,
yeah,
do believe in, when you say the word freedom, what that means. When you say the word love, what that means. You want to accept, you know, someone's use of those terms, you know, as right.
Right, right, right.
And you know, I think he's a political genius for using it. It's a great cloak.
I think a lot of people are going to drink the Kool-Aid, so to speak, on that
one. Kool-Aid.
I never liked the Kool-Aid much, but you know,
especially when it's got a lot of
You're tuned to American Independence Radio. This is Political Dynamite. We'll be right back.
Radio. Never remembers our anniversary.
My mother-in-law. I guess our religious differences. Teeth grinding in the middle of the night.
Leaving dirty clothes on our bedroom floor.
So cheap.
My mother-in-law.
Talks way too loud.
Leaving the cap off the toothpaste.
I never have any covers at night.
My mother-in-law.
Snoring. Whenever I go to drive the car, the tank's empty.
Always late.
The mother-in-law.
You know what's wrong with gay marriages? The same things that are wrong with straight ones. Support same-sex marriage. A message from PFLAG and EqualMarriage.ca.
Tune to American Independence Radio. This is Political Dynamite. I'm Michael Stewart with Adam McGavro in our studios in New York. How are you, Adam?
I'm doing all right. How
good,
you doing?
Good. Good break. We just finished up with the inauguration. A little bit of analysis on our part there,
mm-hmm.
And another big story.
Yep.
Condoleezza Rice appearing before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, seeking this. Position
as
Secretary of State, right? some real grilling,
yeah.
On the part of Democrats on that committee. You had a chance to look at Joe Biden,
yeah,
and how he fared. Tell us a little about that.
I thought he fared great. I thought he spoke well of the Democratic sentiment and his own personal opinions about. Condoleezza Rice being the mouthpiece for George Bush, but not really.
You mean with respect to the war?
With respect to the war,
right?
And selling the war,
right?
And but I felt a little disappointed in his vote, and he voted for her.
He ended up voting for her.
I just don't buy that as a, you know. as a Democrat.
It's a little disappointing, isn't it? Like, yeah. You see a guy, from what I understand, he articulated
absolutely
a lot of problems with this nomination.
People
in the end, he just ended up saying, well, you know what, I'm going to vote for you anyway. I just hope that you change your ways.
Yeah.
And, well, you know, that's all fine and good, but I think that occasionally you just have to stand behind what you believe, even though you know you're going to lose.
Right.
You know, I suspect that perhaps he was trying to hold on to maybe a little bit of political capital with the administration, you know, for his constituency or whatever, by voting for her. But in the end, that really doesn't, I don't think it makes a difference.
And
I think it helps our cause.
Yeah, I think that's also what's wrong with the Democratic Party also, that, you know, we will give someone the benefit of the doubt and say, yeah, all right, you know, don't do it again. Whereas a Republican would, you know, fight to their dying death. You know, they'll never give up.
We've seen that before.
And that, yeah, exactly. Where we give up too easily.
Right.
John Kerry gave up too easily. Al Gore gave up too easily. And, you know, we'll toss in a vote.
Right.
Since we're going to lose anyway.
Right.
It's the wrong message.
Yeah, it could be just an attempt to curry favor on Biden's part.
Yeah, and he was absolutely unhappy with her performance.
Right.
Unfortunately,
we've had our staff try to find the audio of Biden working Condi over. A little bit of hoo, you know.
Hoo-ha. Little ringo.
But we do have Barbara Boxer, though, grilling Condi, and she makes some great points.
Yeah, she did a damn good job.
Yeah, she did a damn good job. So we're going to go ahead and play that for you right now. Here we go.
Now, the war was sold to the American people, as Chief of Staff to President Bush, Andy Card, said, like a new product, for his words. Remember, he said, you don't roll out a new product in the summer. Now, you rolled out the idea, and then you had to convince the people as you made your case with the president. And I personally believe, this is my personal view, that your loyalty to the mission you were given to sell this war overwhelmed your respect for the truth. And I don't say it like that, show your statements and the facts at the time. Now, I don't want the families of those 1,366 troops that were killed or the 10,372 that were wounded to believe for a minute that their lives and their bodies were given in vain. Because when your commander-in-chief ask you to sacrifice yourself for your country, it is the most noble thing you can do to answer that call. I am giving their families, as we all are here, all the support they want and need, but I also will not shrink from questioning a war that was not built on the truth. Now, perhaps the most well-known statement you've made was the one about Saddam Hussein launching a nuclear weapon on America with the image of, quote, quoting you, a mushroom cloud. That image had to frighten every American into believing that Saddam Hussein was on the verge of annihilating them if he was not stopped. And I will be placing into the record a number of such statements you made, which have not been consistent with the facts. When you were doing that now through this confirmation process, and I continued to stand in awe of our founders, who understood that ultimately, those of us in the highest positions of our government must be held accountable to the people we serve. So I want to show you some statements that you made regarding the nuclear threat and the ability of Saddam to attack us. Now, September 5th, let me get to the right package here. On July 30th, 2003, you were asked by PBS NewsHour's Gwen Ifill if you continued to stand by the claims you made about Saddam's nuclear program in the days and months leading up to the war. In what appears to be an effort to downplay the nuclear weapons scare tactics you used before the war, your answer was, and I quote, it was a case that said he was trying to reconstitute. He's trying to acquire nuclear weapons. Nobody ever said that it was going to be the next year. So that's what you said to the American people on television. Nobody ever said it was going to be the next year. Well, that wasn't true. Because 9 months before you said this to the American people, what had George Bush said, President Bush, at his speech at the Cincinnati Museum Center? If the Iraqi regime is able to produce, buy, or steal an amount of highly enriched uranium a little larger than a single softball, it could have a nuclear weapon in less than a year. So the president tells the people there could be a weapon. 9 months later, you said no one ever said he could have a weapon in a year, when in fact the president said it. And here's the real kicker. On October 10th, 04, on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace 3 months ago, you were asked about CIA Director Tenet's remark that prior to the war, he had, quote, made it clear to the White House that he thought the nuclear weapons program was much weaker than the program to develop other WMDs. Your response was this. The intelligence assessment was that he was reconstituting his nuclear program, that left unchecked, he would have a nuclear weapon by the end of the year. So here you are contradicting the president and then contradicting yourself. So it's hard to even ask you a question about this, because you are on the record basically saying, taking two sides of an issue. And this does not serve the American people. If it served your purpose, play the threat of nuclear weapons, you said, no one said he's going to have it in a year. But then later, when you thought perhaps you were on more solid ground with the American people, because at the time the war was probably popular, or more popular, you say, we thought he was going to have a weapon within a year. And this is, the question is, this is a pattern here of what I see from you. On this issue, on the issue of the aluminum tubes, on the issue of whether Al-Qaeda was actually involved in Iraq, which you've said many times, and in my rounds, I don't have any questions on this round because I'm just laying this out. I do have questions on further rounds about similar contradictions. It's very troubling. You know, if you were rolling out a new product like a can opener, who would care about what we said? But this product is a war. And people are dead and dying. And people are now saying they're not going to go back because of what they experienced there. And it's very serious. And as much as I want to look ahead, and we will work together on a myriad of issues, it's hard for me to let go of this war because people are still dying. And you have not laid out an exit strategy. You've not set up a timetable. And you don't seem to be willing to, A, admit a mistake or get any indication of what you're going to do to forcefully involve others. As a matter of fact, you've said more misstatements that the territory of the terrorists has been shrinking when your own administration says it's now expanded to 60 countries. So I am deeply troubled.
Thank you. Senator, may I respond?
Yes. Let me just say that I appreciate the importance of Senator Boxer's statement. That's why we allowed the statement to continue for several more minutes.
I'm sorry, I lost track.
Clearly, you ought to have a right to respond. And then at that point, we're going to have a recess. But will you please give your response?
Yes. Senator, I am more than aware of the stakes that we face in Iraq, and I was more than aware of the stakes of going to war in Iraq. I mourn the dead and honor their service, because we have asked American men and women in uniform to do the hardest thing, which is to go and defend freedom and to give others an opportunity to build a free society which will make us safer. Senator, I have to say that I have never, ever lost respect for the truth in the service of anything. It is not my nature. It is not my character. And I would hope that we this conversation and discuss what happened before and what went on before and what I said without impugning my credibility or my integrity. The fact is that we did face a very difficult intelligence challenge in trying to understand what Saddam Hussein had in terms of weapons of mass destruction. We knew something about him. We knew that we had gone to war with him twice in the past, in 1991 and in 1998. We knew that he continued to shoot at American aircraft in the no-fly zone as we tried to enforce the resolutions of UN Security Council that the UN Security Council had passed. We knew that he continued to threaten his neighbors. We knew that he was an implacable enemy of the United States who did cavort with terrorists. We knew that he was the world's most dangerous man in the world's most dangerous region. And we knew that in terms of weapons of mass destruction, he had sought them before, tried to build them before, that he had an undetected biological weapons program that we didn't learn of until 1995, that he was closer to a nuclear weapon in 1991 than anybody thought. And we knew, most importantly, that he had used weapons of mass destruction. That was a context that frankly made us awfully suspicious when he refused to account for his weapons of mass destruction programs despite repeated Security Council resolutions and despite the fact that he was given one last chance to comply with Resolution 1441. Now, there were lots of data points about his weapons of mass destruction programs. Some were right and some were not. But what was right was that there was an unbreakable link between Saddam Hussein and weapons of mass destruction. That is something that Charlie Dolfer, in his report of the Iraq Survey Group, has made very clear, that Saddam Hussein intended to continue his weapons of mass destruction activities, that he had laboratories that were run by his security services. I could go on and on. But Senator Boxer, we went to war not because of aluminum tubes. We went to war because this was the threat of weapons of mass destruction in the hands of a man against whom we had gone to war before, who threatened his neighbors, who threatened our interests, who was the world's one of the world's most brutal dictators, and it was high time to get rid of him. And I'm glad that we're rid of him. Now, as to the statement about territory and the terrorist groups, I was referring to the fact that the Al-Qaeda organization of Osama bin Laden, which once trained openly in Afghanistan, which once ran with impunity in places like Pakistan, can no longer count on hospitable territory from which to carry out their activities. In the places where they are being sought and run down and arrested and pursued in ways that they never were before. So we can have a semantic discussion about what it means to take or lose territory. But I don't think it's a matter of misstatement to say that the loss of Afghanistan, the loss of the northwest frontier of Pakistan, the loss of running with impunity in places like Saudi Arabia, the fact that now intelligence networks and law enforcement networks pursue them worldwide means that they have lost territory where they can operate with impunity.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to take 30 seconds with your permission. First of all, Charles Dolfer said, and I quote, here it is, I ask unanimous consent to place in the record Charlie Dolfer's report, which he says, although Saddam clearly assigned a high value to the nuclear progress and talent that had been developed up to 91, the program ended and the intellectual capital decayed in the succeeding years. Here's the point. You and I could sit here and go back and forth and present our arguments, and maybe somebody watching a debate would pick one or the other depending on their own views. But I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in the facts. So when I ask you these questions, I'm going to show you your words, not my words. And, if I might say, again you said, you're aware of the stakes in Iraq. We sent our beautiful people, and thank you so much for your comments about them, to defend freedom. You sent them in there because of weapons of mass destruction. Later, the mission changed when there were none. I have your quotes on it. I have the president's quotes on it. And everybody admits it but you, that was the reason for the war. And then once we're in there, Now it moved to a different mission, which is great. We all want to give democracy and freedom everywhere we can possibly do it. But let's not rewrite history. It's too soon to do that.
Senator Boxer, I would refer you to the president's speech before the American Enterprise Institute in February prior to the war, in which he talked about the fact that, yes, there was the threat of weapons of mass destruction, but he also talked to the strategic threat that Saddam Hussein was to the region. Saddam Hussein was a threat, yes, because he was trying to acquire weapons of mass destruction. And yes, we thought that he had stockpiles, which he did not have. We had problems with the intelligence. We are all, as a collective polity of the United States, trying to deal with ways to get better intelligence. But it wasn't just weapons of mass destruction. He was also a place, his territory was a place where terrorists were welcomed, where he paid bomb Israel, where he had used Scuds against Israel in the past, and so we knew what his intentions were in the region, where he had attacked his neighbors before and in fact tried to annex Kuwait, where we'd gone to war against him twice in the past. It was the total picture, Senator, not just weapons of mass destruction that caused us to decide that post-September 11th, it was finally time to deal with this.
Well, you should read what we voted on when we voted to support the war, which I did not, but most of my colleagues did. It was WMD, period. That was the reason and the causation for that, you know, particular vote. But again, I just feel you quote President Bush when it suits you, but you contradicted him when he said, yes, Saddam could have a nuclear weapon in less than a year. You go on television 9 months later and said nobody ever said it was
there. Senator, that was just a question of pointing out to people that there was an uncertainty, that no one was saying that he would have to have a weapon within a year for it to be worth it to go to war.
Well, if you can't... admit to this mistake, I hope that you'll
Senator, we can have this discussion in any way that you would like, but I really hope that you will refrain from impugning my integrity. Thank you very much.
I'm just quoting what you said. You contradicted the president and you contradicted yourself.
Senator, I'm happy to continue the discussion, but I really hope that you will not imply that I take the truth lightly.
So we have it. You can hear Barbara opening a can of whoop ass on Condi, and occasional. It seemed like a couple of emotional breakdowns there.
Yeah, I'll play a violin for Condoleezza Rice.
Yeah,
she deserves one. She needs one. She's playing her own. So.
Right.
You know.
Right.
What are you gonna do?
Right.
I think she did a great job.
Well, that's it for us. We're out of time. You're listening to American Independence Radio. This has been Political Dynamite. I'm Michael Stewart.
I'm Adam McGovern.
Thank you for listening.
This is American Independence Radio.